Hi, this is Hugh Cornwell, and welcome to this Mr. DeMille FM podcast. This show is an interview with Brian Eno, who talks about his favourite film music. I hope you enjoy the show. Hello there, and today I've got great pleasure in welcoming Brian Eno as our guest.
Hello.
And you've brought in a selection of pieces of music from films to play us from your varied past. I mean, how did you, your first connection with film, I mean, what's the first film you ever saw that you remember in the cinema?
The first film that I ever saw that really absolutely changed my life was at my uncle's house. He had rented a little 8mm projector, and he set it up about 2 feet away from the kitchen wall, and he showed a Disney film on it. I can't remember what the film was, but as you can imagine, at that proximity, the image was incredibly bright. It was the brightest thing I'd ever seen, and it left such an impression on me. I was very young at the time, but it left such an impression on me that I dreamed about it for years afterwards, about the power of this light. And I think actually that determined quite a lot of the things that I then went on to do in my life, as these things do. It was silent, actually, as far as I remember. I don't remember any music, so it doesn't directly relate to what we're talking about now. But the first film music that I really was aware of as doing something really special in a film, rather than being just a sort of supporting role, but having a real function in a film, was actually the first thing I want to play, which is Nino Rota's score for Juliet of the Spirits.
The Fellini film.
That's right, exactly. Mm. So I think that film was late 60s, probably something like that. And it's a beautiful film. It's very whimsical and abstract and has this strangely dreamy quality to it. And the music is so actually unexpected. For the type of film that it is, you would never expect this kind of music. It's kind of kitsch and jaunty, and it has two forms, basically. There are only really two melodies in the film. One of them is the happy melody, and the other one is the sort of melancholy melody. And there are many tracks on the record, and each one is a variation on one of those themes. And two things really struck me. First of all, the way he used electronic instruments, because he uses sort of typical Italian small town band instruments like trumpets and accordions and so on. But he then has these very cheesy old electric organs, like Farfisa type organs, with their kind of reedy nasal sounds. And it's a fantastic combination. It couldn't be anywhere else but that place at that time. You know, it sort of identifies Italy in the 60s for me. And the other thing that really struck me was the idea of variation, the idea that for a film soundtrack, you didn't have to, and in fact probably didn't want to, have hundreds of different musical ideas. What really worked was to have the music being like another character in the film. So you keep seeing this character reappearing in different guises, and it gives you a clue as to the emotional landscape that you're in the film. And as I say, the music, there are only two musical characters in this piece. And actually, we're going to hear the melancholy character.
Let's hear that now.
Thank you.
So, Brian, you've next picked some music from a Stanley Kubrick film, who's one of my great outstanding favourites. Barry Lyndon, I thought your choice of film was one of his best films. I really enjoyed that. And is there something about Kubrick that you are particularly fond of?
I like him very, very much. One of the reasons I like him is because really not one of his films is like any other. They're really unusual films in that sense. You could never predict what his next film was going to be. And Barry Lyndon was as different from everything he'd done before and different from anything he did afterwards, actually. It's my favourite film, I have to say. I've seen it so many times now, and I still am just as interested in it as I was the first time I saw it. I think it's brilliant in every respect, technically, because of all those strange things he did with lighting and getting camera lenses, special camera lenses developed. In terms of a story, of course, it's one of the great stories. It's a classic rise and fall type story. But the characters he uses in it, the all of the smaller parts that he found characters for, they're such amazing faces. They're completely unforgettable. Like Leonard Rossiter, for example, who what was that thing he had on television? The Rise and Fall of Reginald Perrin.
Perrin, yeah.
Leonard Rossiter in Barry Lyndon is just one of the great roles, smaller roles in cinema, I think. And the score, it's a brilliant score. It ranges from Irish music, which is an example of which I'm going to play, because the thing starts out in Ireland, and it goes through Baroque music because it moves into Europe.
It goes through Europe, doesn't
it? Yes, into Vienna, and oh, it's a wonderful score. I mean, I could have chosen anything from this. And all of the music in this film now, whenever I hear it, I'm back in Barry Lyndon. I think Kubrick chose all the music himself. Apparently, he had very strong opinions about music. And his opinions were as good on that as anything else he did, I think.
Great. Well, now we're going to play The Chieftains' Women of Ireland from Barry Lyndon.
Thank you.
Okay, now your next choice, Brian, is something by Miles Davis from Louis Malle's first film, Lift to the Scaffold, which was an amazing debut when that came out, quite shockingly gritty and realistic. Are you fond of Miles Davis?
Yeah, I like Miles a lot. I think he's one of those kinds of artists who... He reminds me of Picasso a little bit in that he just kept putting it out without too much self-criticism. It was like thinking... the feeling I always got from him was, well, I've got this gift. I don't know how good it is. I don't know how to assess it. I'll just let the world decide. And history sort of decided. I mean, very much like Picasso. In his later years, Picasso was doing a painting a day, a big painting a day. And I think he just lost any self-censorship. So what that means with those artists is that sometimes you get a real clunker, and other times you get something that is so bold that nobody else would dare release it. Mm. Now, one of the things I like about this soundtrack is that the way Miles did it, apparently, was he gathered together a group of players. They were all Belgians, I think, funnily enough. They all went into the studio and they played to the film. So they stood in front of the screen and the film was run. Sometimes they would run the same bit three or four times and they just improvised to the film. And that's such a fantastic way of doing a film soundtrack. I've never been able to do it myself. It's never worked for me, but it really worked on this, I think.
And again, it's just one basic theme which he works and reworks in different ways. So this is one of the reworkings of the theme from Lift to the Scaffold.
So this next piece is by a band with an unpronounceable name. I shall now try. They're a South African band, and I believe they're called Abafana Basekudeni. Abafana Basekudeni. Yeah, that sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. But there's probably a in there somewhere, which I can't do. So this film, Rhythm of Resistance, Music of South Africa, came out in the late 70s, and it was really a film about the music that was going on there and its relationship to the anti-apartheid movement. And one of the interesting things about all of the music in the film is that it's very, very happy and up. It's not what you would expect from a very political music. It's not kind of earnest and dour and miserable. It's just like a celebration of life. It's so thrilling. And there's a nice note on the album cover, actually. One of the musicians was asked about the joyfulness of the music, and he said, "Resistance is more than the fight itself. It's also about staying human in the face of inhumanity, affirming fate, affirming life." So that struck me as a very nice approach to political music, of just saying, "We're alive and you can't stop us." And this music, this band, Abafana Basekudeni, are five singers who shared a backing band with the Mahotela Queens, who are quite a famous South African singing group. They were five women who everybody knows about. And this type of backing band was called Mbakanga. And that Mbakanga is the name of a type of potato pancake that they eat. It's a very heavy, thick potato pancake. And it refers to the use of the bass in these things. They have a very heavy, solid bass part, and that's called Mbakanga, that style. So this is one of those songs, and this to me is one of the most thrilling and energetic songs I've ever heard. The singing is completely unpredictable. You just never imagine how they arrived at that idea for a way of making a song. I just listened to it again tonight before I came here, and I thought, bloody hell, they're still light years ahead of us.
Let's have a listen to that now.
We'll be right back.
So your next choice, a lighter, from Oklahoma, Gordon McRae and Gene Nelson, a song called Farm and the Cowboy. And obviously, this comes back to your early days growing up, I guess.
Yes, I had an uncle who was a big music fan, and he particularly loved big band jazz of the 40s and 50s. And one time he was moving, so he had to dump his record collection somewhere, and he gave to my father to look after a huge collection of vinyl. And I used to listen to it every morning when I got up for school, because I had to go by train to school. It was some distance. So I'd get up very early and I'd put on one of these records, and I discovered this kind of treasure trove of music that I hadn't ever heard before, actually. I hadn't heard anything like it. It wasn't on the radio at that time. And because there was nobody to tell me, oh, this stuff is cool and this stuff isn't cool, I just worked my way through it. For instance, I completely fell in love with the Ray Conniff Singers. I don't know if you remember them.
Yeah.
This was considered like the most degenerate kitsch music I discovered later. It was sort of the James Last of its day, you know, the Muzak of its day. I thought it was fabulous. And I also fell in love with Jack Teagarden, who was a big white big band. It was sort of the white answer to Duke Ellington or something like that, and has faded into obscurity now. But I still think Jack Teagarden was great.
Yeah.
And one of the other records was this Oklahoma, which was the film of the stage play, had been a very successful stage play, and this is Oscar Hammerstein, who wrote this, and the playfulness and wit of the lyrics and the cleverness of the orchestration and so on, that really opened a new world to me. I'd never heard songs written like that. You know, I'd grown up with rock and roll, which, relatively speaking, are quite simple structures. Yeah. And suddenly hearing these very complicated songs made me think, there's another type of song. And I've codified that now into my theory that pop music is made up of two basic trunks. I call them Jews and blues. So blues music derives from Afro-American stuff and usually involves the basic 1-4-5 blues chords, and is modal in a sense, you know, whereas what I call Jews really comes out of the Central European kind of klezmer tradition. And if you think of Gershwin and Hammerstein and all those sorts of people who are writing sort of sophisticated orchestral music and somehow grafting it onto the pop music of the time, that's much harder to sing, that music.
Yeah.
So here's a good example of a great musical, really wonderful musical. It was revived recently by Trevor Nunn at the National, fabulous version of it. It still sounds good to me. This is Gordon McRae.
And the cowman should be friends. Oh, the farmer and the cowman should be friends. One man likes to push a plow, the other likes to chase a cow, but that's no reason why they can't be friends. Territory folks should stick together, territory folks should all be pals. Cowboys dance with the farmer's daughters, farmers dance with the rancher's gals.
Territory folks should stick together, territory folks should all be pals. Cowboys dance with the farmer's daughters, farmers dance with the rancher's gals.
I'd like to say a word for the farmer. He come out west and made a lot of changes.
Come out west and build a lot of fences.
And build them right across our cattle ranges. The farmer is a good and thrifty citizen. No matter what the cowman says or thinks, you seldom see him drinking in a bar room unless somebody else is buying drinks.
But the farmer and the cowman should be friends. Oh, the farmer and the cowman should be friends. The cowman ropes a cow with ease. The farmer steals her butter and cheese. But that's no reason why they can't be friends.
Territory folks should stick together. Territory folks should all be pals. Cowboys dance with the farmer's daughters. Farmers dance with the rancher's gals.
He treads as difficult and stony. He rides for days on end with just a pony for a friend.
I sure am feeling sorry for the pony.
The farmer should be sociable with the cowboy. If he rides by and asks for food and water, don't treat him like a louse. Make him welcome in your house.
But be sure that you lock up your wife and daughter.
Territory folks should stick together. Territory folks should all be pals. Cowboys dance with the farmer's daughters. Farmers dance with the rancher's gals.
And when this territory is a state and joins the union just like all the others, the farmer and the common and the merchant must all behave themselves and act like brothers.
I'd like to teach you all a little saying and learn the words by heart the way you should. I don't say I'm no better than anybody else, but I'll be danged if I ain't just as good.
So I see you've picked something from Breakfast at Tiffany's. What a great movie that was. Do you remember the party scene in that?
Yes.
It's the best. It's the party I've always wanted to be invited to in my
yes.
life, because there's all sorts of people there, all sorts of ages, everyone having fun. It's the party I've always wanted to be invited to, and you've picked Audrey Hepburn singing something from that. Now, were you really struck with her when you saw her on screen?
Yes, but I have to say, I didn't know this piece of music. I knew this piece of music from, I think it was Andy Williams who did a version of it, didn't he?
Yeah.
It became a hit.
And Matt Monroe, wasn't it?
Maybe, yes. It was Moon River, very operatic, you know. In that sort of 50s crooner style. And that's what I thought the song was. And then I saw the film. So I saw the film quite a long time after it had come out. And the origin of this song is Audrey Hepburn sitting on some steps with an acoustic guitar, which she can barely play, barely singing this song. And it's so touching. It's so utterly different from the version that became a hit. Because she's not really a good singer, but she has such a beautifully fragile voice. Mm. And her, I guess she'd probably just learnt to play guitar for this bit of the film. You know, it's really poorly played in a way, but that makes the film, the music, so moving, I think.
And charming, yeah.
So much more charming than the big male versions of it that came out.
Excellent. So here's Audrey Hepburn singing Moon River. So, Brian, we had to do this. We had to come to your involvement with the film music. And I see that you released an album in the 70s called Music for Films, which, in fact, you tell me, at the time, wasn't music in any films. But since then, has every track's been used in a film. And this track you picked was used by Derek Jarman in Sebastian.
Yes.
So, did this surprise you that this music, or did you really think that this might happen after you made the album?
I did think so. Yes, it was a sort of suggestion to people. Hey, this could be film music. You know, what had happened? The way I got to this was that often when I was working in the studio, we'd be working all day on something, and then in the evening I'd say, I just want to try the film mix, and the film mix for me meant leaving quite a few of the elements out and doing something to the few elements that remained, for instance, putting a lot of reverb on them or just changing the thing in some way. And that was always my favourite part of the day, when I got to do what I called the film version. Not that anyone had asked me to do film versions of anything, actually, at the time. But I just had this feeling that, well, really the reason I loved film music is because, and I always have done, is because in a sense it tells you, start using your visual imagination. As soon as someone tells you something is film music, you start imagining what the film must be. And I thought, what an interesting idea to put out a record called Music for films that don't actually exist.
Mm.
So don't tell anyone that they don't actually exist, but let people imagine what kind of film that might be. And I think the thing about film music is that it sort of tells you, use your visual imagination. Mm. Imagine what you're seeing, what you would be seeing here. So that's really how this album came about. I released it in 1978, and it was very successful in the terms of some of the pieces, nearly all of the pieces, I think. In fact, probably all of the pieces have been used in at least one film. One of them has been used, 36 times now.
Amazing.
It's a very short piece. And I remember making that piece in my little front room in Maida Vale, where I lived at the time. And it was one of those pieces that just fell into place in minutes. It took me maybe 12 or 20 minutes to make this piece. It's not the piece I'm going to play. Sorry, that's very confusing for you listeners. But I knew it had magic, and I thought it had film magic. That was the thing. So anyway, the piece I am going to play is actually the only one on this album that was actually commissioned for a film.
Ah.
'Cause Derek Jarman had heard some of my other music, and he asked if he could use some pieces in Sebastiani. And he said, there's this scene at the end that it's just a long sunset after, it's about Saint Sebastian, after Sebastian has been shot, has been, what do you call it with arrows? Shot, I guess, isn't it? Yeah. He said, there's a long scene where the sun is going down behind him. And that's exactly up my street. So I made this piece for that. But it's, as I say, it's the only one on the album that was really made for an existing film.
And here it is.
Thank you.
So, Brian, I understand that this album you made with David Byrne, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, there's a lot of sampling on it, and one of the samples on there is an Arabic piece of music from an Arabic singer called Samira Tewfik. Is that right? So, and you've actually managed to locate the track that you sampled, isn't that right?
I hope that your listeners will no doubt tell us. yes, in the late 70s, I was sick of songwriting, and I hated the fact that songs were always about me and you and love. And I thought, for Christ's sake, there's got to be a whole lot of other things in the universe we could write songs about. But I also hated the fact that the singer was always identified as the kind of voice of the song, you know. Oh, it must be about him because he's singing it. And I thought, bloody hell, that's so unsophisticated. You don't go to a theatre and think that the character is the author. You know, you realise that authors invent characters. And, you know, I'd been working with Bowie and Talking Heads and so on, and I was fully aware that, and Devo actually, that they were all people who invented characters. They created people and had them sing a song, and then they would create somebody else to sing another song, you know. I thought, that's much more like it should be. But anyway, the upshot of all this was that I was trying to think, what else can you do with songs? What about if you create a piece of music and you find a voice from somewhere else and drop it on top of the music and see what happens? And I started off by using voices off the radio, mostly from totally insane preachers. I was living in America at the time, so there was no shortage of those on the airwaves. In fact, there were so many completely mad people on the radio at that time that I used to make tapes and send them to my friends in England saying, Jesus, listen to this. Can you believe it? This man is on the radio. But anyway, so I started with mostly spoken or rather ranting voices from the radio. And then I was listening to a lot of Arabic music at the time, and I heard this song by Samira Tewfik. And there's sort of quite a long introduction where there isn't too much else going on. I thought, oh, I'd love to try using that voice. This is the word sampling didn't exist then, so this was sort of a new experiment. In fact, we wouldn't get away with it now, but
no.
I took her voice and I dropped it on. Now, dropping it on sounds easy now in the days of samplers and computers, but what that meant was that I recorded it onto a cassette, and I would try to start the cassette at the right moment as the track
ran. The rest of the song was playing.
And it was very hard to do, and it kept sort of dropping out of sync with the song, so I'd have to stop and start it again. It took ages to do it. It was a heroic piece of work, I have to say. The heroism is largely overlooked now because it's so easy to do that kind of thing. But anyway, so suddenly in the middle of this song appears this absolutely incredible singer, Samira Tewfik. And this song was from a film she did called Desert Romance, which I have to say I've never seen. I'd love to see it, but I don't expect I will. Haven't got time for anything like that. Too many radio programs to do. This is the original from which the My Life in the Bush of Ghosts was taken.
Ya malik al-ruh ghayrak ma yamlikha dunya kabira wa anta li tamlikha tamlikha. واحنا عبيدك وانت حاكمنا يا خالق الاكوان ومالكها ومالكها. الله الله
الله الله.
Yeah.
You were saying earlier that one of the tracks from Music for Films has been used 36 times, I think. And this next piece, another one of your pieces, has been used in two films. Trainspotting, I believe, the very famous film soundtrack, two volumes, amazing selling album. And this is Deep Blue Day. What was the other film it was used in?
Well, this piece was originally written with my brother and with Dan Lanois. We recorded it in Canada in 1981, I think it was. And what had happened was that this Texan called Al Reinert, who is the only human being to have seen all of the footage shot on the Apollo missions, the 6 million feet of footage, because all of the Apollo missions were filmed. He's the only man who's looked at it all. Took him years. And he made a film about the Apollo missions called For All Mankind, which, of course, was the thing that Kennedy said. This is not something we do for national prestige. This is something we do for all mankind, or something like that. So he put together this beautiful film, and he asked me to do the music. And so I remembered this one incredibly beautiful scene of where the craft is coming towards the moon. And you have to imagine this. The moon is huge and deep red. It fills the whole screen. And you fly underneath it. Which means, of course, that for the people in the craft, they were upside down in relation to the surface of the moon. And it's the most incredibly beautiful moment when you realize that you are actually upside down. The horizon, the planet is above you, as it were. So I made this piece on a very simple instrument I was using a lot at the time called an omnichord. I don't know if you know the omnichord, do you?
No.
Oh, it's a great tool. It's a toy, really. It's an instrument that plays chords, bass, drums, everything. It all comes out of the omnichord, and you play a little pad that strikes these lovely chords, and you're always in tune. So if you hit A minor, everything you do on the pad will be in A minor. So it's an easy instrument to play. So I recorded this piece on that, and then I slowed it down to half speed, so the bass is like the biggest bass
very
you've
strong,
ever heard.
Yeah.
It's a 20-foot high string bass. And anyway, that film had a life, actually. It was re-released not long ago. But the real success for this piece came many years later, when quite out of the blue, it was put into the film Trainspotter in a particularly nasty scene where somebody dives into a lavatory.
I remember that scene.
But suddenly that film, because that soundtrack was so successful, suddenly that piece of music, which had been sitting around relatively unnoticed for 15 years or so, suddenly made more money than the whole of the original album and all of the original film it made.
For the other film.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing. Here we are, Deep Blue Day. So I notice your next choice, you've picked something by Elvis Presley, the song G.I. Blues from the movie. So is Elvis someone you've got a lot of time for?
When I was young, I wasn't very keen on him. He was, of course, very, very popular. But I was a snob, and I thought Elvis was a bit showbiz. And I preferred weirder people like Clarence Frogman Henry.
It's a bit manufactured for you, sort of thing.
Well, he was glossy, you know. And I also knew, and I had some sort of indignation about the fact that he had basically taken black music and marketed it to white people because he was white.
And stolen their songs.
Stolen their songs and stolen their moves, you know. I already, by the late 50s, when I was quite young, I knew about Arthur Big Boy Crudup.
Oh,
wow. That wonderfully named man who was really the forerunner to Elvis. Arthur Crudup, who probably should have changed his name if he wanted a career. But if you listen to him, you think, oh, right, that's where Elvis got it from. However, over the years, I have to say, I have come to think more and more of Elvis. I think he's an absolutely great singer. And he was one of those sort of brainless great singers.
And a great performer, too.
Great performer.
Stunning.
No brain to speak of, unfortunately, which is why he was so easily manipulated. And he was manipulated into doing a lot of really daft things. Like, most of his films were so ridiculous. And, of course, they were successful because he was in them for only that reason. There was nothing else in them except for G.I. Blues, that film, which had an amazing soundtrack. And this particular song, I think, is one of the wittiest, cleverest pieces of writing. It fits perfectly into the category I was saying earlier of Jews versus blues. Well, this is Elvis doing Jews rather than blues, which is what he did in his early career. It's a very cleverly crafted, quite complicated song, and he handles it brilliantly, I think.
So here we are with Elvis Presley singing Did You Ever from G.I. Blues.
Do you ever get one of them days, boys? You ever get one of them days?
Yeah.
When nothing is right from morning to night, you ever get one of them days, boys? You ever get one of them days?
Yeah. Days.
You get up in the morning and turn the shower on.
Yeah.
You get pneumonia, the hot water is gone. Freezing, sneezing, you wanna dry your back. Well, do you ever get one of them days when there's no towel on the rack?
Yeah.
You ever get one of them girls, boys? You ever get one of them girls who's awful nice but cold as ice? You ever get one of them girls, boys? You ever get one of them girls?
Yeah, girls.
You're at a drive-in movie with a cute brunette.
Yeah.
Counting on the kisses that you figure to get. Closer, closer, then she hollers, whoa.
Oh.
You ever get one of them girls who just wants to watch the show?
You ever get one of them days, boy, you ever get one of them days.
When nothing is right from morning to night, you ever get one of them days, boy, you ever get one of them days.
Yeah.
You're on a Sunday picnic, then it starts to pour. You run through poison ivy, scratch until you are sore. Ants come dancing, carry off the bread.
Oh.
You ever get one of them days when you should have stayed in bed?
Yeah.
You ever get one of them?
One of them days.
So I see here you've got a track by David Bowie in there, and this is, I think, the I'm Deranged from Lost Highway, and this is you worked on this track, I think, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah. I'm co-writer, I think.
I love this track. It starts the beginning of the movie, the lights are going along the middle of the highway. It's a fabulous track.
Yeah.
Is it one of the favourite things you've done with Bowie?
Well, yes, it was another thing that came as a bit of a surprise, because it started out, as you know, things sometimes start somewhere in the studio and end up a completely different place. And it started out as an entirely different kind of song. And one day suddenly went deranged. and that was the day we knew it was something special. And I think Trent Reznor put together this soundtrack, didn't he, for Lost Highway?
Yeah.
It's a great soundtrack all the way through. And he chose two versions of this, actually. There are two different versions. I think we'll listen to the shorter one, but there's also a longer version at the end, which is arguably even more deranged.
Is it just the two of you on that, or were there a lot of
other... No, there's quite a few players, including Mike Garson, the amazing pianist, who sprinkles a bit of Atonality in there. But I have to say, when I listen to that again, I really think, why didn't people get it? Because, you know, when that album came out, it wasn't very successful. Hmm. It was just so brilliant what he was doing there. I think of him like a painter who was just sort of slightly outside of his time. He's painting these amazing pictures in a way that nobody has ever painted pictures before. And people didn't quite get it. They all paid attention to it because it was Bowie, but they didn't like it very much, I felt. And when I listened to that again, and that way of singing that he had over the years kind of engineered and honed into this completely individual style. Nobody else ever sang like that before. It's to do with all the things that he knew about, like how to use a microphone and how to place a voice in a space, you know, in what kind of reverbs you use, where you put it in relation to the other instruments. There's so much experience in that recording.
It sounds quite improvised too, what he's singing too.
He worked like that. He would work from improvising and then formalize it into a song. But he was just so much better at doing that than most other people. I'm sure he was very disappointed when that record came out, because I think some of the stuff on that album was among his best work.
The album being?
Outside, it was called, right. The album. And I think that, you know, when you do something that you know is really, really good, and people go, oh, that's kind of different, isn't it? Or the sort of stupid things people say. That's quite nice, yeah. And then they move on to the next thing. You think, bloody hell, I put about 40 years of experience into that.
They'll get it later.
Well, the trouble is, of course, nobody's arrogant enough to think they'll get it later. They think, maybe I didn't do it right.
Mm.
That's what really happens, is that you end up doubting yourself. And then when they do get it later, you think, I wasted all that time doubting myself.
Worrying.
I could have just gone on to the next step. Yeah. It's happened to me a few times, I must say.
And you worked with Bowie in Berlin, didn't you, on that trilogy of the trilogy of albums?
So we did those three in the late 70s. And then we did this one in the mid-90s. In, I think, 1995 we did that. And it was a very thrilling album to do. I mean, it mostly came from improvisation on the part of all the musicians. And, in fact, I still have something that I hope one day he'll release. We once did, in a room together, we played for 72 minutes. A kind of suite, really, which he improvised the singing over, and it turned into this amazingly complex and interesting story, which finally became something called Leon, which sort of became the backbone of the album Outside. But the original improvisation, which I listened to again not very long ago, is absolutely incredible. You think, how could anyone do this without having a plan in advance? Because we had only talked. We hadn't played anything at that point. We just started playing. And, you know, we were sort of giving directions to each other as we ran, but we carried on. We didn't really stop in that 72 minutes. And it went through all sorts of moods. It was the most incredibly fascinating day I've ever spent, I think, in a studio.
Where was this?
This was in, I think we were in Montreux, yes, Montreux in Switzerland, yeah.
Down, down, down.
So, Brian, we're going to finish up the this fascinating program with you. You've picked a reworking by Joni Mitchell of one of her earlier songs called Both Sides Now from a film, a very popular film called Love Actually. And it was arrangement was arranged by Larry Klein. What is it about this that stands out for you?
Well, I have to come clean about this. I first heard this version of the song in a theatre piece by Hoffe Schechter called Patriot Mother, which was going around a couple of years ago. I got it at the Brighton Festival, in fact, when I was curating that. It's the most amazingly frantic and frenetic and violent theatre piece, actually. And the end of the piece is... it's an hour-long piece, and then it has a five-minute ending where the whole piece is performed in reverse at super high speed by the cast. It's the most incredible thing you've ever seen. It just unwinds the whole tape, as it were, of the piece. But it's done live, and it's frantic. It's insanely strange to watch. But over it, he had this piece of music playing, this beautiful, incredibly luxurious, melancholy piece of music. And it was one of the strongest things I've ever seen. So I really wanted to play this tonight, but I know this is about films, so I had to find out whether this had ever appeared in a film. And luckily it had. It appeared in a lightweight film called Love Actually, which I've never seen.
I haven't either, unfortunately.
But that's my... that's my alibi for having it in the program.
Well, we got it in, and that was the important thing.
Actually, I have to say that having never seen Love Actually, I have no right to dismiss it as lightweight. I know a lot of people who love that film, and one day perhaps I'll love it too.
Well, let's hope that we both get to love it in the end. Brian, very nice of you to come in. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
And we're going to just now listen to Joni Mitchell with her newer version of Both Sides Now.
Rows and flows of angel hair, and ice cream castles in the air, and feather canyons everywhere. Looked at clouds that way, but now they only block the sun. They rain and they snow on everyone. So many things I would have done, but clouds got in my way. I've looked at clouds from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow it's cloud illusions I recall. I really don't know clouds. Moons and Junes and Ferris wheels, the dizzy dancing way that you feel, as every fairy tale comes through. I've looked at love that way, but now it's just another show, and you leave them laughing when you go. And if you can, don't let me know. Don't give yourself away. I've looked at love from both sides now, from give and take. love's illusions that I recall. I really don't know love. I really don't know love at all. Tears and fears and feeling proud to say I love you. And circus crowds, I've looked at life that way. Oh, but now, old friends, they're acting strange, and they shake their heads, and they tell me that I've changed. Well, something's lost, but something's gained in living. Every day I look at life from both sides now, from win and lose, and still somehow it's life's illusions I recall. I really don't know life. It's life's illusions that I recall. I really don't know life. I really don't know life at all.